An interesting thought, listening to Napoli and then a devotional song and people who come to a meditation retreat might wonder, what are they doing singing a song like la 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 la? And yet it's a very interesting truth that without laughter, without gaiety, without energy, the spiritual practices will not be nearly so effective. It's that's why Yogananda said, read one funny story every day. And why singing a cheerful gay song like that can help, because what it does is raise the energy, and until you've got energy to focus, merely focusing isn't going to help much. Many people who sing religious songs tend to get into that trap of no energy, because it's inward and they haven't raised their energy first. My subject this morning is how to awaken Kundalini. And what we were talking about earlier is very important, because without energy, we don't have the possibility to grow spiritually or in any other way. And it's important to realize that this energy, which is symbolized in Kundalini and expressed in Kundalini, is the essence, really, of spiritual development. I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen, a lot of people who were devotees, who are on the path, who lack the one thing that's needed. They're very good, but they don't have any energy. In some cases, we find in history, a very interesting example was the example of Valmiki, who was a highway robber, who became a saint. We find sometimes that people who are very far from being saintly, because they have a great deal of energy, as he had, are able to make very quick spiritual progress, where other people with every good intention and pious wish somehow don't seem to change very much over the years. I remember when we first went to India, there was one person in our ashram there in Calcutta who wanted to, perhaps he was wanting to show us how pious he was, I don't know. Maybe he did this all the time. At any rate, he gave they had a service that they put on for us, and he did the Kriya interpretations. And he was talking like this: Krishna spoke in the Bhagavad Gita that Arjuna should. Fight the good fight. And so on I went. We were choking up inside. But you've all seen a sort of a pious, like the time when I visited the Four Square Gospel Church of Amy Semple McPherson in Los Angeles, and the person who was showing us around wanted to show us again how pious she was. And so when they came to the sanctuary, they said, and this is where we worship Jesus. Sometimes you sort of want to get behind somebody and give them a good, you know. It's a very interesting fact that those people who are great in any field are people of high energy. And without energy, there can't be greatness. Greatness is sort of the cornerstone. Without, if you read the poetry of François Villon, he was probably the most famous poet of his century in France, but he was also a thief. And you wonder how such a poet could be that famous. And you read his stuff, and it's jolly good, in fact. What makes it good? His consciousness was low, but he did have energy. And you will see that this is a very, very important thing in any field, that the geniuses in any line, whether it be in the arts, whether it be in science, they will always be people of extraordinary energy. Edison, I believe it was, who said that genius is 99% perspiration, but perspiration isn't really what it's about. It's energy. Putting out enough energy to perspire, okay. But I've seen a lot of fruits of perspiration that didn't get very far as art went. I'm reminded of an article that I saw in the paper years ago of somebody, he was an immigrant to this country, and to show his gratitude to America for taking him in, he had spent 25 years constructing a replica of the Statue of Liberty with matchsticks. There was a lot of perspiration went into that work, but I can't say that it had anything else going for it. Energy, however, is something else. You don't have to perspire when you're putting out energy. You may or you may not. The thing is that the amount of dynamic willpower, yes, Master said the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. But it takes willpower first, but that willpower acting upon the energy and directed toward the fulfillment of whatever it is that you are trying to accomplish. This is the real answer. Most people think that they just have or haven't energy, that a person is a person of high energy or is not. But the truth is that we all have locked up within us the potential for the greatest possible energy in the universe. We have locked up within us the potential to somehow offer this little bit of consciousness, this little seed soul, into the infinite, to grow like a mustard seed and spread out to infinity. We have all the power of the universe locked up within us. Master used to say that in one little gram of flesh, there is enough latent energy to keep the city of Chicago in electricity for a week. And yet we go around saying that we are weak because we don't have willpower. That's part of it. But on the other hand, the other part of it is that our energy, our willpower, is working against itself. We want conflicting things. And we have committed ourselves to things that we don't even remember that we've committed ourselves to. And yet, in the subconscious mind, that memory is there. People under hypnosis, which incidentally I don't recommend, because it has a debilitating effect on the willpower, but I'm not going into that discussion now. I'm just saying that so that you not think, well, because he talked of hypnosis, therefore, let's try it. But people under hypnosis, it's very interesting how they have been made to relive something that they've forgotten altogether. And they've actually gone into hysterics, paroxysms of grief. They've just been overwhelmed. You can see that energy that they had forgotten all about is still there. There's a very deep-seated complex that may be holding them back from further progress, some deep-seated disappointment to which they had given a lot of energy, and that energy isn't yet released. And there are many, many such things in our subconscious, not all of them that traumatic, but when you add them up numerically, they come to such a huge amount of commitment of our potential energy that it's no wonder that we have little energy to wake up in the morning, little energy to accomplish the things that we set out to accomplish in life. I remember this very high energy yogi in Kashmir that I met a few years ago, and he asked me what time I got up in the morning, and I said 4 o'clock. He said, 4 o'clock, that's for householders. You should get up at 1. and the thing is that when you have lots of energy, you just feel that there's nothing that can stand in your way, sleep or fatigue or anything. These things are trivial. And the other thing is that when you're around high energy people, you pick up something of their energy too. I remember working all night with Master once, and just by the fact that he was there, I felt no fatigue at all. Those people who worked with him frequently all night found that that was always so. And Master writes in the autobiography of a yogi about how sometimes they would stay up all night talking with Sri Yukteswar, and suddenly they'd notice that, it was dawn, let's walk by the Ganges. And Master said at such times, I never felt any fatigue. being around high energy people, being in high energy places, these things too are very helpful. Kundalini represents the furthest pole of our outward moving energy. There's a very interesting corollary between that energy and the cycle of the solar system in the yugas that Sri Yukteswar explained it. He said that in the center of our galaxy there is a grand central sun, and that our sun has a dual. And as we rotate around that dual, it's interesting that a year or two ago there was something in the papers about astronomers suspecting that we may have a dual, because only in this way would it explain eccentricities in the orbits of the outer planets. But anyway, Sri Yukteswar stated this as a fact, and it's interesting that other things that he stated as a fact were unknown at that time and have since been found to be so, such as the location of the center of the galaxy, the fact that we're moving toward it, and the fact that matter is energy, and so on. There are one or two other things. As our sun rotates around its dual, as it approaches the center of this galaxy, we're way out on the outskirts. It isn't that we get very close to the center even then, but as we come closer to that center, the rays of energy from that center are stronger and stronger until we reach an apex at the closest point. As we recede, those rays of energy that reach us are weaker and weaker until at the farthest point we are in the darkest age. This age was reached in 500 AD, or more exactly 499 AD, when our solar system reached the farthest point away from the center of the galaxy. And now we are starting to move toward that center again. So we have these two poles in the movement of the solar system too. The pole that is closest to the center of the galaxy, the highest pole spiritually, and then that which is farthest away and completely locked in the spirit of, in the sense of matter. In Kali Yuga, in the darkest age, mankind can only think in terms of matter. He can't imagine that this world is made of energy. He can't imagine energy, in fact. All he thinks about, except a few very unusual people, the average man is incapable of understanding anything except in terms of solid matter, fixed dogmas, rigid institutions. Everything is crystallized, everything is form, everything expresses the lowest quality of divine manifestation, which is matter itself. In the human body, we find a similar situation, that there is going out from the medulla, the grand central sun of the body is the spiritual eye. And from the medulla, going out, we have, this is the anatomy of the spiritual body, we have the irda and the pingala, which we were singing about, these two, the sympathetic nervous system, these two currents which you find in the anatomy of the body, the physical anatomy, but they have their spiritual counterparts too in the astral body. And these things go out from the medulla and unite at the base of the spine. At the base of the spine is the lowest quality of our consciousness, representing the earth element, that element of the body which is completely, mind you, when they speak of elements, they mean elemental stages of manifestation. They're not talking of oxygen and hydrogen and so on. Those are elements of chemistry, but elements of divine manifestation, which is what the old traditions were speaking of when they spoke of air and ether and fire and water and earth as the basic elements. What they meant was that the subtlety of spirit manifests itself more and more grossly through ether and gases and the fiery state, and then the molten state, and finally solid matter. We see this in the galaxies, the spiral nebulae, which first are gaseous and then gradually they coalesce as they become more dense and become fiery stars, and then matter cools down to the point where it is molten, And then finally it cools to the point where it becomes solid earth and rock and all the differentiations that we see around us. But this earth element manifested in the body is represented by the lowest chakra, the lowest center in the spine. And this is called the earth chakra because it represents that movement away from our freedom in spirit into total bondage to matter. At this pole is to be found what is known as the Kundalini. And it's a curious fact also that in the spiritual writings of India, in the centuries of Kali Yuga, you find virtually no mention of Kundalini. Mention of Kundalini begins again with the growing awareness of the energy in matter and in the body. It's only in the last century, basically, that you find the saints talking more about Kundalini. In the past, they didn't discuss it. If you read Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, even, you'll find no mention of Kundalini as such. You'll find experiences described that we know to be experiences of Kundalini. But whereas the teaching of Kundalini is buried in those scriptures, it isn't overtly taught. There is one point there in the Mahabharata, an interesting passage, where Arjuna wins as his bride Draupadi. And when he and his four brothers come home, before they enter the house, they call out to their mother, and Arjuna says, "I have won a prize." And the mother, not knowing what this prize is, says, "Well, be sure to share it equally with your brothers." And when she discovers it's a wife, then of course there's some amount of embarrassment, but the words of the mother cannot be gainsaid, and therefore Draupadi becomes the wife of all the five Pandavas. An unusual situation, because androgyny was not a part of the Hindu culture at all. This is the only case of it that I know of. In Tibet you find it. But the meaning of it is subtle. It was not a cultural phenomenon. It was the inner meaning of it is Draupadi stands for Kundalini. And the brothers stand for the chakras in the spine. And Kundalini needs to be united with all five chakras before spiritual enlightenment can be achieved. All these passages in the Mahabharata, the very names, are all rooted in psychological tendencies and truths. Thus, each of the Pandava brothers stands for one of the different chakras. And the whole story is very, very deeply mystical. But here we find a reference to Kundalini, but obviously very abstruse, the sort of reference that yogis would understand that the average person wouldn't. Kundalini is that pole away from the highest aspiration, the highest pole in the body, which is here at the point between the eyebrows. And these represent the tension that keep us in a state of matter consciousness. Anything that takes our energy toward matter helps to strengthen the grip that Kundalini has upon us. Kundalini represents an actual pull. It's sort of like two square dancers dancing, or I guess it's not square when you only have two people dancing. It's contra dancing, is it? Where they're going in a circle, and by pulling away from each other, they're able to go faster and faster and faster without being pulled off center. So Kundalini represents that pull with balanced against it being the higher center. With the two, the actual pull in this direction makes possible our involvement in the material world. And when we start trying to go back toward God, we find that indeed there is a magnetism toward that which takes us in the opposite direction. It's not easy because we've already, that force has been generated toward that which operates against our spiritual aspirations. Nobody can say that this force is not very real in his life. There is the life wish, but there is also the death wish. And it's a very important part, a very basic part of everyone's consciousness. It isn't that everybody wants to commit suicide, but it's interesting the extent to which this consciousness can express itself subtly. Like, whenever you feel unwilling, whenever you seek escape in too much sleep or unawareness in one kind or another, this is why people drink, this is why they take drugs, this is why they... I remember I mentioned this in the path after seeing the razor's edge. I heard a girl say, if only I could go to India and get lost. And I said, whom would you lose? Because we can't lose ourselves, but we have this thought that maybe we can. So we think to run away. We think to run into some place that has nothing to do with our present realities, and maybe in the unawareness that sort of maybe a lotus kind of land would give us, we think to find release. But this is all a part of the death wish, a wish not to face reality, a wish that would, if a sort of thought that if we can be less aware, then our problems will be solved. We can't solve our pain, so what we want to do is numb ourselves to that pain. We find this same tendency when people are afraid to express love for one another. They're afraid of being hurt. I was so intrigued by something that happened years ago when Preeta was living in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, and she invited me and several of us to visit her home. And she had several friends there whom she invited over to dinner. And we ate out under the sky, under the trees, and she asked me to sing some of my songs. And I sang a song, and these guests stared at the ground and looked up at the sky and glanced at the trees, and there was absolutely no reaction at all. And I thought, well, let's try another one. So I tried another, and the reaction was the same. And I thought, well, I'm Preeta's guest, and I want to do what she asked me to do as a guest. And on the other hand, I don't want to commit a social outrage against these people's sense of taste. And so I didn't know quite what to do, but I said, well, shall I sing another? Yeah, sure, go ahead. So I sang maybe two more, and I felt that perhaps my duty had been discharged, and I put the guitar up, and nobody said anything, and we ate dinner. Well, the next day, I went with one of the main ones of them in the car somewhere, and I asked him I was sort of intrigued by this total lack of response. I asked him, how did you like the songs? They're all right, they're fine. In fact, I have a cassette tape of them, and I play it every day when I go to work. I couldn't believe my ears. Here he liked the songs so well that he played them every day, and yet he couldn't bring himself to say he liked them or to show that he liked them. You can understand people not liking something and not showing a liking that they didn't feel. But to feel a liking and not show it, to feel love and not show it, to feel enthusiasm and be afraid to express it for fear that somebody will put you down, this was a very strange state of consciousness, and I've seen that quite a lot in people, perhaps more in the East than here, but it's a human phenomenon too, that people are afraid to say, I love you, for fear that the person will just laugh, split his sides laughing, or as Bertie Wooster put it, you nearly, when I proposed to you last, you nearly laughed yourself into a state of permanent hiccups. And so they're afraid to say, they're afraid to commit themselves to enjoyment. This too is a part of the death wish or the death impulse, the tendency to want to not express, the tendency to be afraid to feel love. People will always write high feelings off as mere sentiment. But the fact is that they either have buried it completely or they're doing their best. People are afraid to love others for fear of... I remember one person put it to me perfectly honestly when he said, I'm afraid to love people because then they'll love me, and I'll have to do things for them. He was afraid of the energy that it would demand. This is why, again, people are afraid to express love, not only because of the fear of not being appreciated or having their love accepted, but of the fear of the commitment of energy that it entails. That if you love your neighbor, then you're going to have to be constantly busy doing things for him and with him. And yet what happens is that the more you put energy out. I've seen this has been the biggest stumbling block to people on the path too, that they're afraid to put energy out because then they think that it will be a commitment of energy that they'll have to do more and more and more. And the truth of it is that it isn't a matter of strain at all. It's a matter of, as you do it, more energy comes. As you feel more energy, you feel joy in expressing more energy. Just to put out a little bit of energy, and you find that door opening. And you find that the people who are the happiest in this world are invariably people of high energy. People who think it's too much trouble to put out energy are also not happy. Don't be afraid of that trouble. But here's what happens, is that as you put energy out in the right way, automatically you're starting to loosen that grip that Kundalini has on you, matter has on you. You can almost use the words interchangeably. That Kundalini represents that energy that leads you toward unawareness, that leads you toward selfishness and ego and bondage and everything that sort of takes you into a smaller and smaller awareness of life and of the world around you. It represents a definite flow of energy, because when God himself created this universe, he manifested it out of himself, not merely in the sense of, well, I'll make a clock, and I'll make a planet, and here's a person, and there's a doggy. What he did, rather, was send out a flow of energy. And from that flow of energy, all these manifestations of energy came automatically. There was, in fact, the divine is not responsible even for creating the individual planets. He sends out that energy, and that energy, a stream of consciousness, manifests itself as particular definitions, entities. And those entities are actually the angels that create the universe, the planets, and so on. But that flow of energy is a flow in itself. It's not a thing. We live in the world of things. We live in the world of phenomena. And so we think of creation in terms of the things done. But really, creativity is a matter of an energy flow, a flow of consciousness. And what comes of that comes almost automatically. If you want to create things, you don't have to think, what shall I create? You have to get yourself into that frame of energy, and then the produce of that, the results of that, will come automatically. God sent out this flow of energy, and once that flow of energy started, then it kept going. What is the satanic force? It's that flow of energy. That doesn't make that which God did evil. We don't understand the meaning of good and evil. Evil is that which takes the mind farther away from wherever it is in relation to God. It's evil to us. There's nothing evil in the ultimate sense, because everything is abstract. Everything is merely good and evil don't exist. They are merely plays of light and shadow in the great and impersonal vastness of God. But where we are concerned, it becomes evil, because some things take us out of attunement, take us further away from the good that we seek in true joy and true love and true light. And some things take us back more and more toward that center in ourselves. An example of what I mean is one that I've given here on occasion. If, let's say, Jesus Christ, halfway through his career of teaching, had decided that he was fed up with serving mankind and wanted to become a millionaire, everybody would say, my gosh, well, he's really fallen, wouldn't they? But supposing a very lazy person who never did anything and just sort of sat there and waited for the peaches to fall from the trees into his mouth, got up one day off of his bed of ease and decided that he was going to become a millionaire. I don't think anybody would fault him. Everybody would say he's doing a good thing. Isn't it so? What would be manifestly wrong for one person becomes quite obviously right for another, depending on where we are in the universal scale of values. There are some teachers today, some writers, who claim that values are relative because everything's relative, and that means that anything you want to do is fine. They don't understand what relativity means. Einstein spoke of relativity in relation to a fixed phenomenon, the speed of light. And when we speak of relativity of values, we still have the fixed phenomenon of union with God. And everything is relative, yes, but that doesn't mean that when, for instance, Albert Schweitzer found that kindness among some of the tribes in Africa was considered merely weakness. They didn't respect kindness at all. Does that mean that they have just as much right to their opinion as we have to ours? Yes, if you want to talk of right, we have a right to be stupid, too. But can you look at those people? Can you imagine seeing such people as shining examples of human wisdom? I think fairly obviously not. That as a person grows, no matter what culture he's in, he reaches certain levels that are universal. This universal truth being God, and the universal goal of life, union with God, then anything that takes us into a greater sense of that unity will be taking us toward the ultimate reality. If that's true, then quite obviously kindness has more of God in it than unkindness, in this sense that kindness is the quality that automatically grows when you feel yourself a part of the universal life stream. When you feel yourself in others, when you feel that they are a part of you and therefore that their happiness is your happiness, and that taking from them is in a very real sense taking from yourself. These principles can't change simply because they are based in that ultimate reality. Then kindness is not something that is a sociological decision or opinion. It's not a fad. It's an ultimate reality, or I should say it leads us toward an ultimate reality. Therefore, when we speak of these different qualities that man manifests, we find that there are some which, in this relative scale of values toward the highest value of all, which is unity with God, there are some that lead us toward it and others that lead us away from it. And what makes it wrong to go away from it? It makes it wrong for us. It doesn't really matter to the universe whether you choose to walk in darkness or walk in light. The light is there and the darkness is there. It's your choice. But you suffer. Ultimately, whatever harm you do much more harm to yourself than to anyone else. If you live in the consciousness that draws you back toward the divine, then you will find more and more joy. And if you try to get away from that, and let's face it, that's what we all try to do at times, is to pull away from that light. Every time we do so, we are the ones who suffer. What we need then to understand is that Kundalini, this is just a small, it may be the central reality, but it ties in with all these other things, that whenever we allow ourselves to be pulled by that other pole in ourselves, the pull toward darkness, the pull toward death, the pull toward essentially unconsciousness. Anything that makes you less aware is bad. Anything that gives you less energy is bad. Anything that gives you more energy and makes you more aware is taking you in the right direction. There are, of course, detours. For example, you can become more aware by studying certain things and become more aware of a totally trivial thing. Some people are extraordinarily knowledgeable about absolute trivia. To put that much energy into that kind of awareness is better than not putting it into anything at all, but the fact is that you'll end up wondering where you've gone and why you did it. Awareness itself needs to be cultivated, not awareness of specific things so much. And we need to use those things in order ultimately to help us to achieve the highest awareness. Ultimately, that is the best kind of energy which takes us into the spine. And it's curious how music, as an example, is influential in this. There are certain kinds of music that relate to different chakras. But in all cases, you'll find that music can be a cause of energy. Martial music. I remember walking down the streets of New Orleans, the only time I ever went there, in the French Quarter, is that what it's called? I just soon forget. It was quite a scene. But anyway, there was this music blasting out of some bar, and I saw this family. It was just an ordinary family, but this young girl, probably about 19, had obviously been nurtured on this kind of music, and I remember her being caught by the mood of it and starting to sort of dance and clap her hands. And just that little quick glimpse, I could see how what was happening was that with the movements, she was feeling a little bit more energy in the spine. With the rhythm, she was feeling a little bit more energy in the spine, and if she'd just taken it upward, it could have helped her. One time, Master was playing the drums. They were chanting. And Dr. Lewis, who was a Boston dentist, this kind of Indian drumming smacked to him rather too much of tribal rights in the Congo. And Master said, get into the feeling of it, Doctor. It'll help you to raise the kundalini. It'll help to raise the energy in the spine. And so Doctor, sort of with a sense of duty, got into it. But indeed, the energy, the rhythms, that which tends to sway the body as one tends to do with rhythmic music, all of this has the subconscious influence of getting you centered more in your spine. And if you can take that energy and move it upward, instead of getting into that kind of rhythm which takes you downward. For instance, take disco music. Take the beat of disco. It gets you into the spine, but it heads you very quickly in the wrong direction. And I've really, quite seriously, I've read articles on studies of the effect of rock music, and it has a very negative effect upon the body. It's not merely a matter of taste, but that kind of beat does take you into the spine, but it all is related to the lower chakras and getting the energy moving downward, so that they've actually found that people who listen to a lot of it, their nervous systems start to fail, give them a lot of trouble, their health is not nearly so good. It has very deleterious effects on the body. But rhythm in itself, if it's used in the right way and not just sort of a pounding thing that, you see, there's a kind of rhythm that can sort of beat you into unconsciousness. And there's another that can sort of inspire and get you to sort of feeling like dancing in the spirit. If it takes your energy up toward the higher chakras, then that kind of rhythm can be helpful. There are indeed mechanical ways of getting the energy to go into the spine and to flow up the spine. Rhythm, music, chanting. Master used to say that chanting is half the battle because it helps to raise the energy. I remember one time at a Christmas meditation, we were chanting and he said, whip up energy in the heart. Whip up devotion, I should say, in the heart. The sort of using the energy that you feel from chanting to whip the energy in the heart and get yourself to feeling, and then directing that feeling upward is an important part of meditation. Too many people enter the silence and drift. We must understand that at no point is the spiritual life passive. It's so full of contradictions, isn't it? Because receptivity is the essence of spiritual development. And yet passivity is the opposite of spiritual development. You can't be passive. How can you be receptive and not passive? The answer is, we could put it this way. Leaving your cup there on the table for somebody to come and fill, or holding it up and asking him to fill it. They're both are receptive, but one has energy in it and the other one has passivity. You say, God, I'm perfectly willing that you come to me if you want to. That's passive receptivity. I mean, if that's your thing, Lord, sure, go ahead. And the other is yearning and holding your heart up, asking him to come, but knowing that he's the one who has to fill it. That takes a lot of energy. I'm just thinking of times that people have asked me a favor, which perhaps I didn't feel like giving. If they've asked with enough energy, I couldn't possibly say no. Even if it meant lots of trouble, I couldn't possibly say no. You ask with enough magnetism, and then you draw what you want. When you pray to God, you have to pray that way, knowing that it's his power that does it. Still, you're not forcing him, and still you're drawing him. Receptivity means also to draw to yourself a divine response. Master said that we can't possibly find God until our prayers become so magnetic that they draw him into our orbit. And this kind of drawing, this kind of love, is possible when we can bring the energy up and offer it all to him. Now, the influence of Kundalini on our minds is the opposite kind, the kind of, well, let it happen as it will, thinking that they can... I've seen this in the arts, for example. You will find that this is a very common phenomenon, for example, in poetry, that people will try to give the impression, to convey the impression of profundity by being utterly vague, because they haven't the clarity to be able to say something really clearly. They think if they make it vague enough, people will think that they're saying it anyway. The thought that by being less aware you're going to solve your problems. The thought that by being less aware you're going to be able to impress others, to express God, to be inspired. Many people in their teaching, I've been amazed to see how people even respond more to this, that if you can say things that make no sense at all, it's sort of like Hitler's technique of the big lie, make no sense at all, people think, well, gosh, he must be awfully wise, because I don't get a word of it. And so you'll find that such teachers often have a big following. One of them, I read a book of his, and I said, this is garbage. Maybe my comment got to him because his next book was called Garbage and something or other. In fact, I read a rather startling article. They asked a number of different professors in college what their opinion was of 10 different magazines in their own field, graded all the way from the most intellectual to the most simple. And they all, without exception, thought that the most intellectual and the most abstruse was the best researched and the most intelligent and so on. And then they did a very interesting thing. They took an article from the simplest one and rewrote it in the language of the most intellectual and pedantic one. They didn't change a single thought. They only put it in very abstruse English so that it was hard to understand. And they asked these same professors what they thought of these two articles. Without exception, they all said that the more wordy one was better researched, better thought out, more intelligent. It's a little discouraging when you spend your whole life trying to make things simple to realize that a vast majority of people don't want it simple. They think that they're going to be getting a lot more if they don't know what you're talking about. But this is, again, the tendency of the downward movement of Kundalini, the thought that we can avoid, go into muddy thinking, go into less clarity, less awareness, less feeling, anything that takes us away from that blazing light into darkness, that this will somehow solve their problems. Indeed, we have this constant pull, and it can be seen on many, many different levels of our lives. We will be able to achieve enlightenment not only when we offer ourselves up to God and He chooses to come to us. As Master said to Debbie, who asked him for his blessings, he said, "God's blessings are there, my blessings are there, your blessings are lacking." We have to put ourselves into the picture. We have to try also. And the way to try ultimately all comes down to this simple teaching of offering our whole self, or that is to say, transmuting our negative pole into the positive pole. We have to unite these two in one. The pull of the Kundalini is to say, or the downward pull of Kundalini is to say, we'll be able to find that unity if we can become totally unaware. If we can bring the highest down to the lowest. This has actually been a part of the teaching of some psychologists, that if you want to really become self-integrated, then get out there and have a good time and stop suppressing your lower nature. They don't take into account that in that case you'll be suppressing your higher nature. And in the process you'll be suppressing your true nature, whereas they treat the higher nature as sort of a cherry on the sundae. Unnecessary. What you want to get at is the ice cream. And so they think of the higher nature as being the untrue. They see human evolution as merely the product of the refined product of the lower self. The explanation of evolution is always in terms of the lower, not the higher. Whereas another explanation of evolution would be strictly in terms of the higher and of its constant pull that draws life to evolve new and new forms, which will express that it's not just a battle for survival of the fittest. It's really a desire for wisdom and understanding and so on. As I've mentioned in my book, Crises in Modern Thought, it isn't only a desire for food that motivates a tropical fish, let's say, swimming in warm waters. It could just stay in one spot and just eat its heart out. But no, it's darting back and forth. Why? Presumably because it also enjoys what it's doing. There is a certain level of enjoyment. It would be absurd not to see it, that there is also a certain level of curiosity. Why would those original fish that came out of the sea come out? Was it only because they didn't have enough food to eat? Maybe it was also that they wanted to see what was up there above the water. Curiosity is a part of all forms of life, and especially the higher ones. And so that curiosity can be understood in a more and more refined way until finally we reach the longing for wisdom, the longing for enlightenment. This longing can never be buried. We may ultimately be able, in fact, those who have achieved that state tell us that this is our goal and our destiny, to be able to unite the lower with the higher, to be able to finally transmute all that death wish and negative impulse into a completely positive, joyous enlightenment. But we can never, and never have we found anybody who found a negative kind of enlightenment. When Sartre wrote his book, Saint Genet, he was writing about a man of vice, who was so self-honest in his vice, so proudly vicious, you might say, that he deserved to be called a saint, because if that was his value and he totally gave himself to that value, then what makes him less a saint than a Saint Francis who gives himself totally to his values? Why should we be so narrow-minded as to think that only Saint Francis is right? This was Sartre's way of trying to prove his point, and of course making it so preposterous that he managed to disprove it. But at any rate, no man like that really is a saint, because he shows no qualities in himself, ultimately, of real self-integration. If we take self-integration as Sartre would in that case, as the definition of sainthood, we see that such a person is not integrated. There is always something inside us that longs for something more. Kundalini needs to be awakened, needs to be directed back toward the brain, toward the highest center, and they need to be united at that height before we can achieve what we're looking for. All of us, every one of us, the rocks even, everything in this universe is longing to get back to what it really is, longing to get back to its state of freedom in God. So when we want to raise Kundalini, when we speak of it, most people don't even know what they're talking about. We must see that Kundalini is tied in with all the attitudes of life. That it's not just a matter of techniques. Those people who think to raise Kundalini only by techniques rise to a certain level and then fall again, because they haven't understood all that's entailed. Kundalini represents that part of us which pulls away, and we need to learn how to pull it back. We need to learn how to say yes to life. We need to learn how to be completely positive. It would be a wonderful thing in your daily practice to just never say anything negative. Difficult practice. Some people just glory in negativity. And it's a hard habit to break. But try to say yes to life. Try to say yes to other people. Try to find good things to think about other people, to say about other people. That even if they have faults, don't they also have virtues? Why not concentrate on those virtues? Try to be supportive of their wish to grow. Try to be helpful. A wonderful practice would be to mentally pray for a person if you're in his company. Or if you see somebody looking sad, mentally send him a prayer. Always think in terms of those attitudes that will help you to achieve the thing that we're talking about. That kind of attitude that affirms greater awareness rather than less awareness. That is brave enough to express love rather than withhold it. Not caring whether the other person, the person to whom you're showing love or kindness or anything, will appreciate it or not. Do it for your own sake. This gives you a sounder motive for being kind and forgiving, because you never know how people are going to treat you. They have their own misunderstandings to deal with. And you'll find that very often when you try to act in the right way, they will misunderstand your motives and see all the wrong motives there. Don't worry about their reaction. This is what Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita, to act without desire for the fruits of action. But if you can keep constantly giving the supportive and loving thoughts for your own sake, if for no other. Yes, you want to help people, but you want to help them because it's the nature of love to help. Be in that central core of love rather than on its periphery in the world of reactions. Be joyful. Don't be afraid to do things thinking, well, if I do this, then I'll have to do more tomorrow. Master said, every day's meditation should be deeper than the day before. And I can see people just getting all uptight with that thought. Just think how much energy you're going to have to put out in a week, a month, a year. But what happens is, so interestingly, is that the more you develop, the less effort it takes. Master spoke about the path of Kriya and meditation. Painful at first, then effortlessly liberating. And the hardest work is in the beginning. The more you get really squared away and that upper magnet begins to be stronger than the lower, everything starts to enter into it. And I have never yet seen or heard of a saint who was embittered by his sanctity. Nobody that I've ever heard of found God and said, forget it. Every one of them has said this is what it's all about. This is what we're all looking for. And they are all people of great energy. I think this is the downward movement of that power within us that says, oh, but I don't want to come up to that level. It's too much trouble. But what we should remind ourselves of is that even if we can't imagine ourselves on that level of energy, put yourself out of the picture and just look at those people who are on it. Do they regret being on it? Don't be afraid of spiritual progress. That's a part of what I'm talking about too. There is a fear. I remember a time when I went through of really being desperately afraid of peace. I longed for it with one side of my mind. I was scared to death of it on the other. It's a strange delusion, and I knew it was a delusion, thank God. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here now. But there is, in all of us, I suspect, on some level or another, fear of the very thing that we know that we have to strive for. Fear of that perfection, fear of that purity, fear of that calmness, fear of that absolute joy, fear of being totally aware so that you can't ever go to sleep because you're always aware. Can you stand it? How would you be able to live with if you go to bed at night and suddenly all you're seeing is light and you can't get those... Well, it's wonderful. But the ego doesn't like it. It's the soul that likes it. And so put yourself out of the picture and look at those people who have achieved these things, and you have to admit that every one of them was exceedingly happy with it. None of them said, God, what a lot of trouble I've gotten myself into. And so have enough faith to at least take one foot and put it in front of the other. And don't worry about how it's going to feel when you're in cosmic consciousness and your consciousness is absolute. My God, how can you stand it? Just think, well, a little bit of meditation has made me happier. A little bit more will probably make me still happier. And let's let the future take care of itself. To awaken Kundalini means to just try every day, step by step, to get into a more positive frame of mind, a more life-affirming frame of mind, a frame of mind that will make you essentially more aware rather than less aware, more energetic, not less energetic. And in conjunction with that, but never without that, you will find that the techniques that are taught in yoga for awakening Kundalini can be helpful. But even there is a very important point to be understood. I remember Yogi Bhajan, who teaches Kundalini Yoga, saying that yogis say to stay away from onions and garlic. We start with onions and garlic. Well, in fact, it isn't just a matter of stimulating those lowest chakras. It's a matter of raising the energy from those chakras. And the way to raise the Kundalini, the lower way of generating energy from the base of the spine, isn't nearly so effective in the long run. It may have an immediate result. It may give you a certain amount of powers even. But, as I say, you'll fall from that. What you need to do is generate a magnetism in the upper part of the spine that will ultimately draw that energy upward. When you've done that by living in your higher centers, by living a saintly life, by living a loving life, a joyful life, being constantly in tune with God, you need to get into the spine. You need to realize that it's not just pious wishing, but really feeling your center in the spine and really offering that energy, giving that energy upward, that then you will begin to feel automatically this movement from the base of the spine starting to go upward. You may feel spurts of energy going up. You may feel a rotating current. You may feel just a surge of energy and joy. But it all will be in the spine, and the more you can directly, deliberately, consciously live in the spine, the more you will find these things happening. There is a mechanical aspect to it all. Those exercises which merely try to stimulate Kundalini by deep breathing. By there are certain yoga postures where you bang the base of your spine on the ground in order to shake the Kundalini loose, and violent breathing exercises that create so much heat in the body that energy has to go somewhere. This is not safe. I remember one. I remember one disciple of Yogananda was doing Viparita Karani Mudra, and he did it long time every day, and one day suddenly he felt this tremendous heat like a red hot poker rising up his spine, and it was very painful and very frightening, and he got under a cold shower and did everything he could, but when Yogananda saw him, he really scolded him. He said, "I told you not to do those exercises, because they can be very damaging. If you generate an energy that you're not ready for, it can burn your nervous system up." And so some of these techniques are actually very dangerous. But if, on the other hand, you generate a magnetism here that draws that energy up, then it's not dangerous at all. It's the only way to go if you want to become enlightened. You must raise Kundalini if you're to achieve spiritual enlightenment. It's not a question of, well, some paths do it and some paths don't. All paths have to if they want to get you to God. Some may not talk about it, but this will have to be the result of their teaching if they really are leading you to enlightenment. The important thing then is to awaken Kundalini, but in the right way, not forcibly, not violently, not from below, but from above, with love, with devotion. Every thought that you have that leads your mind upward automatically is helping to raise the Kundalini, to loosen its grip. It's as if it had a grip, because it's an outward thrust, and you want to reduce that outward thrust and finally convert it into an inward thrust, an upward thrust toward the Spirit. Every kind thought, every act of devotion, every time you chant and bring your energy upward, it will help. But what will help you particularly as yogis is to try, every time you do it, to recognize what is happening in your spine. Whenever you respond to something in a positive way, there will be a movement upward in the Ira nerve channel, in the it's supposed to be on the left side, but actually think of it as in the center, it's easier. Every time you feel a positive reaction, there will be a tendency to inhale, which is associated with that upward movement of energy. Every time you feel a negative reaction, you tend to sigh, trying to, as if pushing it out from your body, and there is a downward movement of energy in what is known as the pingala nerve channel, nadi. And this inward movement is always there. If then, instead of seeing something that you love and getting all excited outwardly, you would take it in yourself and be aware of this movement in the spine, you will be closer to exerting an actual influence upon Kundalini. Even the downward movement can be good if it takes you deeper and deeper inside. That's why in the practice of Kriya we feel a very fine current going down, because it takes us deeper and deeper in the spine in order to get to that point where the real Kundalini awakening can take place, which is only in the deep spine. If you want to control your destiny, you'll live more here. You can't control things outwardly, but the more you control your own reaction, the more you will find that the world will respond to that reaction. That by controlling the energy within yourself, outward events adjust themselves to that inward control. I knew a yogi in India once who wanted to go to Madras with 9 other people at a time just following massive floods that they had had in the area of Nellore, I think, Andhra Pradesh. And as a result, of course, the seats were booked for just, there was a long, long waiting line. And he sent somebody down to get 9 seats, 9 reservations. And I said, well, how can he possibly expect to get them? And this friend of mine said, oh, he'll get them, no problem. He always does. I don't know how he got them, but yes, he got them. He had so much inner control, inner power, that anything that he wanted just happened that way. He didn't have to think of specifically how he could make it happen. The world simply reflects back to us what we put out. But what we put out needs to be clarified. And it becomes clarified, and we really gain control over our own destiny to the extent that we have control over this reactive process within ourselves, so that we become no longer an effect, but a cause. We're no longer reflecting back to the world what it's putting out, but we are setting into motion the various things that we attract to ourselves. This is what it means to become really the master of your destiny. And the more you have that inner power, centralized awareness, the more you'll see that everything outwardly reflects that. That's why you should live more in yourself. And every time you experience anything, you react to anything, always understand that this is where the reaction's really taking place. For example, you see something beautiful, you hear some beautiful music, you meet somebody whose company you enjoy. In all such cases, recognize that the enjoyment really begins here, not there, that it's centered in yourself, not outside. If it were outside, everybody would get enjoyment from the same things. But in fact, one man's meat is another man's poison. It isn't things in themselves that have joy, it's our reaction to them that gives us joy. The reaction, in any case, begins here. And so if we can discriminate and always accept at our center whatever we feel, whatever fulfillment we achieve, whatever joy we have, and even the pains that we have, feel them here. Recognize that this is where they originate. And how people treat you, good or bad or indifferent, doesn't matter very much. How you respond is what matters. And this consciousness you will have more and more clearly fixed in your mind. And this is why Kriya Yoga is such a very high science, because it helps you to become aware of. You'll have it more the more you become aware of and live in the spine. That's why yogis say always keep your spine straight. Never sit around with a slouched spine, because you want to live in the spine. You want to live feeling the energy in the spine. And anything that you see in the world, always feel that your awareness of it begins at your center. And refer it back to that awareness and feel the flow of energy in the spine. Then you will see that this energy, as it becomes centered, begins to want to start to move upward toward the brain. This is Kundalini awakening. The more strongly you feel it, the more it's real awakening and not just sort of advance scouts, you might say, trying to test the territory, which is what it is in the beginning. A lot of people feel a great surge of energy and think, oh, my Kundalini's awakening. It's not necessarily that at all. It could be just a little partial spurt of energy. But that's good too. Any kind of upward flow is, if you get into it, will help you toward this awakening. Now, the one thought, perhaps most important of all, is not to be afraid of it. I spoke of the danger. That's a danger when you force this thing to happen. But when you get into the natural flow, there's nothing to be afraid of. Have faith and just allow that divine energy to flow with devotion. Without devotion, it's not good. But make it a matter of self-offering up to God. Now, the next thing that's important is the blessings of the Guru. Attunement with the Guru. His magnetism is necessary before you can achieve anything. You need a Guru. You need to be in tune with that Guru. You cannot just achieve this thing on your own. You don't realize what you're talking about if ever you say that, well, I'm my own guru. Indeed, the purpose of the guru is to bring you to the point where you can be. But to think that you know what you're doing, and to think that you have enough power to really raise your consciousness to cosmic consciousness when you're sitting there struggling with not going to sleep when you meditate. Man finds it very hard to generate that level of energy, that level of magnetism. The guru's purpose, ultimately, far more important than books, all the things that could possibly be said have already been said. No new gurus needed to say something new, and they don't ever say something new anyway. They're always basically saying the same things, with love God and serve God and so on. It's their magnetism that they're there to give you. And the more you're in tune with that magnetism, the more you find that your own consciousness changes and grows. To be in tune with the guru, this plus Kriya Yoga are both exceedingly important, or other techniques, but Kriya is it's a very high technique because it's so central to what this whole thing is all about. The way to be in tune with the guru is to, this is what Master said, serve his work. Not just inwardly think of him, but you find that when you draw upon him to be a channel for his energy, then you gain a lot more from him. The channel is blessed by that which flows through it. So to serve his work is a very, very important thing. It's not, Swami Shivananda said that many government servants, after they retire, will build themselves a little hut, a little kutir on the Ganges near Rishikesh, and they wonder why they aren't getting anywhere spiritually. It's because they don't serve. They're not being channels for the light. They should also try to help other people. They should try to serve other people. And to serve the guru's work means to draw people to it, to bring people up here, to tell them about the books, to try to, with the consciousness of the guru's love, to try to help other people, and not just with the thought of, I love these people, but how can we together, the guru and I, help them? You find that with this, you attract more and more of that magnetism. Why not just get it straight from God? Well, you will be getting it as straight from God as you possibly can if you do it this way. Because in fact, God comes down through channels to this level. Just as the electricity from the center of, from PG&E, let's say, at its central areas, is too strong for a household. It has to be stepped down by transformers. God works through the transformers of his saints to be able to reach down to this level of consciousness that we live on. And thus to attune yourself in that way is a very, very important thing. Attunement with the guru, techniques, and acting in those, with those states of consciousness and with those attitudes that are compatible with what we've been describing here as Kundalini awakening, that which takes you toward more awareness. Anything that takes you toward more awareness, anything that dulls your attention is bad. Anything that makes you absent-minded is bad. Master used to say that fillers is one of the worst things. As soon as you have a free moment, turn on the TV. This is bad because it dulls the concentration, dulls the awareness. Try at all times and in every way possible to express more and more conscious living. And in this way you will find that Kundalini is really not a thing, a phenomenon, it's really your consciousness. That you are awakening your animal self and transmuting it into your true self, which is an expression of God.